Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopbriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
This article is from The National, date 30th September 2022, from the Culture section. Tommy Sheridan pays tribute to Coolio with Celtic throwback photo by Sarah Campbell. Tommy Sheridan has paid a touching tribute to US rapper Coolio today following the news of his death aged 59. The pair formed an unlikely friendship while appearing together on Celebrity Big Brother together in 2009 and went on to remain close pals over the years. Sheridan tweeted this morning, "Devastated by the sad news this morning. This guy was multi-talented, great fun and larger than life. He will be missed by everyone who knows him and loved him. You will never walk alone, pal. Rest in peace, #Coolio." Alongside the heartfelt message, Sheridan posted a photo of himself and the star clad in Celtic scarves. During a visit to Glasgow in 2017, the duo famously attended a match at Parkhead with Coolio carrying the Paradise Windfall draw, much to the delight of the crowds. Months before then, an interview with the Glasgow Times, the Gangsta's Paradise rapper said, "Tommy Sheridan is my good friend. I will probably go to his house for dinner when I come to Scotland, like I did last time. He has a lovely family. Hopefully we'll get a chance to hang out. I would like to introduce him to some of my friends. Tommy is good people. I like his conviction. He stands up for what he believes in and I like that." Coolio, whose legal name was artist Leon Ivy Jr., died at the Los Angeles home of a friend on Wednesday. That article was by Sarah Campbell. This article is from The National, date 3rd October 2022. From the Culture section. University of Glasgow project to investigate contemporary Scots use by Jane MacLeod. A new University of Glasgow project will look at how Scots is used in the 21st century in different parts of the country. Speak for Yourself, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, will crowdsource the words, sounds and sentences used to provide an online record. People will be able to log on at speakforyourself.ac.uk to tell the project team about the words, sounds and sentences they use via a series of anonymous interactive resources. Professor Jennifer Smith, a professor of sociolinguistics based at the university's School of Critical Studies, said, "Lots of people say, oh, I don't speak Scots. But just because you don't sound like Robert Burns doesn't mean you're not speaking Scots. We sometimes have an idea that Scots was something that was spoken centuries ago and has now largely disappeared. But step out on Sucky Hall Street in Glasgow or Union Street in Aberdeen and you'll hear people sounding distinctly Scottish. We know intuitively that people across Scotland sound very different. So here we want to capture those differences, providing a record of how Scots is spoken in the 21st century. Scots comes in many colours. The Scots spoken in Aberdeen is very different to that spoken in Glasgow, but it is all Scots. Speak for Yourself project is not interested in how Scots should be, but what it actually is today. Mary Robinson, Research Assistant on the Speak for Yourself project, said, "Scots is not just a subject you learn at school. It's a living language that's spoken by millions of people in Scotland, whether they realise it or not. There's no wrong way to speak Scots. These surveys aren't a test to determine if you're a real Scots speaker or not, or if your speech is Scots enough or not. Instead, it recognises that there are as many valid ways to speak Scots as there are Scots speakers." Bruce Jansen, Scots Language Coordinator for Education Scotland, said, "It's been fantastic working with the University of Glasgow on this new Scots language resource. Digital resources such as Speak for Yourself are invaluable for both modern education settings as well as from promoting use of Scots language in education." That article was by Jane MacLeod.
From the National, Monday the 3rd of October 2022, from the comments section, George Caravan, "Putin has made nuclear war a distinct possibility." Nuclear war is now a real possibility. Even the single use of so-called tactical atomic warheads in Ukraine as a face-saving demonstration by a retreating Kremlin regime will legitimise nuclear war for the rest of the century. All the existing 9 nuclear powers, America, Britain, France, China, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea and Russia itself, would feel either emboldened or forced to factor an atomic exchange into their geopolitics. Armageddon looms. Am I being unnecessarily alarmist? It is difficult to explain to current generations how we children of the 1950s felt about the appearance of nuclear weapons in the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The world of the 1950s and most of the 1960s believed it was permanently on the brink of an existential atomic war between the Soviet Union and NATO. The Cold War was always code for the imminence of mutual assured destruction, or MAD in the parlance of the times. We went to school knowing that alarms could sound that we in Britain was only a 4 minutes warning of death by rocket. The current generation, certainly those born after the Great Towers negotiated fractional nuclear reduction treaties in the 1970s, know of nuclear war only as a theoretical possibility, not as something likely to happen tomorrow morning. But in 1962, during the Cuban Missile standoff between Kennedy and Khrushchev, lessons at my school simply stopped when the American blockade came into effect, because we expected nuclear war that very day. That bleak spectre has now returned to the world, following the Russians' invasion of Ukraine and what has now become a de facto permanent military conflict between NATO and the Putin regime. However, despite acres of press reporting about Putin's nuclear saber rattling, I don't feel that the media, the political class, or people in general are appreciative of the line that's been crossed regarding the threat of nuclear annihilation. Perhaps the current generation is too close to other forms of potential planetary extinction, through global warming or another pandemic, to single out atomic war as a supreme anxiety. In fact, I think the climate emergency takes precedent as an issue for most of those under 30. Yet there is a profound difference between the threat from a nuclear war and the very real dangers arriving from global warming and the likely crossing of the 2 degrees Celsius barrier. Global warming is real, palpable, and will affect all our lives, but it is a slow motion catastrophe, which is not to minimise its consequences, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. Nuclear war, on the other hand, could lead to a spasm of destruction that is instant and immediately fatal for billions of people. Of course, it is a contest between the monsters Scylla and Charybdis to sink humanity, in which death is certain either way, but the nuclear Scylla will do it more quickly. Am I just reliving the nightmares of my own childhood? I don't think so. The world has been moving irrevocably towards the real legitimisation of nuclear weapons as ordinary since the turn of the 21st century. First, America and Russia have dismantled the rickety but still effective set of arms control treaties painfully negotiated in the 1970s and 1980s. For instance, Donald Trump withdrew America from the 1987 treaty limiting cruise missiles, so the Pentagon could develop a new set of strategic atomic delivery systems. The so-called START-1 treaty expired in 2009. Its carefully drafted replacement specifically excluded new weapon systems, allowing the Pentagon and Moscow to concentrate on the next generation of atomic death. And last week, Putin suspended Russian participation in the new START treaty, effectively ending atomic arms control. Concurrent with these legal shenanigans, the big powers have begun a major updating and expansion of their nuclear weapons capability, with little or no public debate. A world steeped in consumerism or, at best, preoccupied with climate change, has had no stomach for opposing the new generation of death machines. Worse, perhaps, Cold War pragmatism between the power blocs has been replaced by an arrogant US hegemony and the doctrine of liberal intervention. Increasingly, Western public opinion has been conditioned to favour interfering in other nations' affairs, especially China, on grounds of human rights or humanitarianism, as if the West was Simon Pure. In fact, as with China, this liberal interventionism is used to justify American military might and its nuclear expansion. After all, a global policeman needs a nuclear truncheon. So President Obama, that paragon of liberalism, set America on a course of nuclear modernization, spending $1 trillion extra just on new atomic weapon systems. This included 12 new missile-carrying submarines with a new missile system, a new strategic jet bomber and, crucially, an upgrade to America's so-called tactical nuclear bombs. This was liberal interventionism with a nuclear tip. No wonder Beijing and Moscow followed suit, though on a smaller scale. The danger now lies in miscalculation. A cash-strapped Russia, with an economy the size roughly of Spain's, has tried to bluff the West by threatening to use tactical nukes at an early stage in any land conflict. I doubt the West would use nukes tit for tat. But if Russia crosses the nuclear line, NATO will give Ukraine the wherewithal to strike deep inside Russia with conventional weapons. Then we are on a road to Armageddon. The modern generation has never learned our 1950s fear of atomic radiation, the silent killer, nor the prospects of a nuclear winter as the radiated dust clouds ejected by atomic blasts blanket the globe, cutting off sunlight. What can we do to roll back nuclear war? A lot of faith has been put in the United Nations Treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. This attempts to create a legal framework that will effectively outlaw atomic warheads. That may sound pie in the sky, but the key proviso is that the treaty enjoins signatories to agree for no first use of atomic weapons. NATO rejects the treaty because it rejects making a no first use commitment. Note, this creates an impediment to a future independent Scotland joining NATO if the SNP keep their avowed commitment to signing the treaty. A no first use commitment is important in its own right. Britain and NATO should make such an undertaking now, regardless of the UN Treaty on Nuclear Weapons. Allied to publicly rejecting extending NATO membership to Ukraine, it would be a clear signal to anti-Putin elements within the Russian establishment that the West seeks to avoid confrontation with Russia. That might create conditions for peace in Ukraine and for the fall of the Putin regime. At the same time, forcing NATO to adopt a no-first-use stance would start to roll back the West's remorseless slide towards adopting a new and destabilising nuclear capability. How do we force NATO to adopt that no-first-use doctrine? That would require a new peace movement, undoubtedly linked to opposing Putin's warmongering in Ukraine. A new peace movement that unites dissidents in the East as well as the West, and one that keeps the SNP committed to support for the UN Treaty. And that was a comment piece by George Keravan. From The National, Monday the 3rd of October 2022, from the comment section, Kirsty Strickland, Liz Truss's conference speech could be her last stand, by columnist Kirsty Strickland. Liz Truss, in an interview during the BBC Sunday with Laura Kunzberg yesterday, made the bombshell announcement that we are not living in a perfect world, we are living in a very difficult world. She was speaking as the Conservative Party conference kicked off in Birmingham, an event which is predicted to be like the bloodiest battle scenes from Game of Thrones. After spending a week in hiding, the Prime Minister had no option but to finally emerge from her bunker to try and explain precisely how tanking the economy will help level up the UK. She did so in the manner of a startled rabbit caught in the headlights of a heavy goods vehicle. Never have awkward silences conveyed so much meaning. Each pause served as a reminder that, during a time of national crisis, we have been led by somebody utterly out of our depth. Having failed to address the central question of why her government punched itself in the face, she has started talking about pies. It's a step up from pork imports, at least. Truss revealed that her economic strategy is based on growing the pie. "We need a bigger pie," she said. A statement so profound that I think you'll agree it was worth waiting a week for. The idea that if we grow the pie, then more people can have a slice of the pie. Under her plans, bankers and millionaires are saved hefty wages of the pie and asked if they would like custard on the side, while ordinary workers are free to help themselves to any crumbs that fall from the linen napkins onto the floor. In a contender for understatement of the year, Truss admitted that the mini-budget wasn't exactly a roaring success, but she attributed this not to its content, but to the delivery. She claimed taking the UK to the brink of financial collapse was merely a result of shortcomings in the communication strategy. "I'm sure a TED talk on why it is right to borrow money to fund tax cuts for millionaires will have alleviated market concerns. But fear not, weary citizens, for Truss has a plan." Unfortunately, she says she can't set out what the plan is or reveal any details of it whatsoever. But it's definitely real and it's definitely coming, much like my plan to get a six pack by Christmas. Maybe we should at least give Truss some credit for showing her face. Most people cope with the abject humiliation by hiding under the duvet and turning off their phone. But there she was, on the telly, not answering questions. What a hero. Conservative Party confidence isn't usually blockbuster viewing. This one might just buck the trend. The economy is not the only thing Truss has managed to tank. She's also turned her considerable raking abilities towards her party's own fortunes. Poll after poll shows the Tories heading for electoral oblivion. Apparently, letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister have already been sent, and she is facing a rebellion on the mini-budget vote. Michael Gove, now free from the constraints of ministerial office, has resumed his role of polite assassin. He was on hand to comment on Truss's disastrous interview yesterday, and he didn't mince his words. He said he was profoundly concerned by the measures set out in the mini-budget, and that the 45p rate cut displayed the wrong priorities. When he was asking if he was voted against it, Gove said, "I don't believe it is right," which in politician speak counts as a resounding yes. This is only a taster of the drama to come. Conservative Party Chairman Jake Berry is talking tough and says any Tory MP who votes against the mini-budget will lose the whip. If Truss pushes ahead with her fiscal plans and ignores the concerns not only of the markets and the public, but also her own backbenchers, there will be a fair few Tory MPs who face that fate. If that happens, the polls showing Conservative seat predictions might come to pass long before the next election. During the months of instability under Boris Johnson, you got the sense he was just trying to get through to the next day. Truss seems to be fighting to survive hour by hour. The Tories know they're on the way out. Conference will be an opportunity for them to air their grievances, plot against the leadership and update their LinkedIn profiles. We can see how this will eventually play out, but we shouldn't underestimate the Prime Minister's ability to trip over her own feet all the way there. This is a government in freefall, launching from one disaster to the next. When Truss gives her big speech to party members, it will truly make or break. Her best option is to say she was drunk during the mini-budget discussions and that she's scrapping the whole thing. A U-turn would be humiliating, but it is necessary. If the lady is not for turning, then she'll be setting herself for an almighty fight with her MPs, one that she will undoubtedly lose, one way or another. And that was a comment piece by Kirsty Strickland. From the National, Monday the 3rd of October 2022, from the Opinion section, University of Glasgow Project to Investigate Contemporary Scotch Usage by Jane McLeod. A new University of Glasgow project will look at how Scots is used in the 21st century in different parts of the country. Speak for Yourself, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, will crowdsource the words, sounds and sentences used to provide an online record. people will be able to log in at speakforyourself.ac.uk to tell the project team about the words, sounds and sentences they use via a series of anonymous interactive resources. Professor Jennifer Smith, a professor of social linguistics based at the University School of Critical Studies, said, "Lots of people say, oh, I don't speak Scots. But just because you don't sound like Robert Burns doesn't mean you're not speaking Scots. We sometimes have an idea that Scots was something that was spoken centuries ago, and now it has largely disappeared. But step out onto Sulky Hall Street in Glasgow, or Union Street in Aberdeen, and you'll hear people sounding distinctly Scottish. We know intuitively that people across Scotland sound very different, so here we want to capture these differences, providing a record of how Scots is spoken in the 21st century. Scots comes in many different colours. The Scots spoken in Aberdeen is very different to that spoken in Glasgow, but it is all Scots. Speak for Yourself project is not interested in how Scots should be, but what it actually is today." Mary Robinson, research assistant on the Speak for Yourself project, said, "Scots is not just a subject you learn in school. It's a living language that's spoken by millions of people in Scotland, whether or not they realise it. There is no wrong way to speak Scots. These surveys aren't a test to determine if you're a real Scots speaker or not, or if your speech is Scots enough or not. Instead, it recognises that there are as many valid ways to speak Scots as there are Scots speakers." Bruce Houston, Scots Language Coordinator for Education Scotland, said, "It's been fantastic working with the University of Glasgow in this new modern Scots language resource. Digital resources such as Speak for Yourself are invaluable for both modern education settings as well as for promoting use of Scots language in education." And that was a comment piece by Jean McLeod. From The National, Tuesday the 4th of October 2022, from the news section, "Gender Stereotypes Around Work Established from Early Age, New Report Finds," by Ross Hunter. "Gender stereotyping of the labour market begins from an early age and can limit future career opportunities for children in Scotland, a new report has found. The Scottish Apprenticeship Advisory Board's Gender Commission report highlighted that by the time most businesses began engaging with young people during S3 or S4, stereotype views are already entrenched. It stated, "These views led to 70% of girls thinking a career is rewarding, compared to 40% of boys, and believe that STEM careers are more suited to men." The report makes a series of recommendations for employers, which include having a proactive strategy to promote and ensure gender diversity through activities such as Bring Your Child to Work Days. It calls on industry and trade bodies to create engagement campaigns on gender diversity that are aimed at key transitional stages for young people. The role of early years education is also stressed, with work to be done to improve gender balance in the sector and encourage more men into the sector. "We know that gender stereotypes can be established as early as age 2, said Jane Brumpton, Gender Commission member and chief executive of Early Years Scotland. "The early learning and childcare sector, therefore, has a vital role to play in supporting early approaches to gender diversity, which can affect the workforce of the future. I am pleased that the report recognises the vital importance of parents, carers and early years professionals in shaping an early understanding of gender diversity." Chair of the Gender Commission, Natalie Buxton, Managing Director at global communications firm Weber Shandwick, added that action was needed across sectors if the problem was to be tackled effectively. She said, "It is clear that the lack of gender diversity is not specific to apprenticeships. Instead, it reflects the broader, long-standing gendered norms that exist within the labour market. Action is needed from everyone across the system, and much earlier than we previously thought. As an employer-led commission, we wanted to provide clear advice on action that businesses can take, and there are some immediate, quick wins that any organisation can benefit from. We would urge employers, those who influence a child's career choice from the earliest years, and the Scottish Government, to take this work forward and change the way we think about addressing gender diversity in the workplace." The report includes case studies from organisations who have been successful in breaking down gender barriers through a proactive approach, highlighting some examples of good practice which can easily be replicated by other organisations. Examples include drinks firm Grenbarangi, which deployed anonymous recruitment practices, and award-winning Early Learning Centre, Shawmuir Nursery in Glasgow. Marion McKenzie, head of Shawmuir, said, "I am delighted to see Shawmuir Nursery included as an example of good practice within the Genders Commission report." And Shawmuir is spelt S-H-A-W-M-H-O-R. We know that language is so important. How we speak to children, our choice of words, and the assumptions we make about jobs and who can do them, all have a significant impact during the formative years, creating barriers which can limit a child's outlook and opportunities. And that article was by Ross Hunter. From The National, Tuesday the 4th of October 2022, from the politics section, Kwasi Kwarteng blames Queen's death for many budget mistakes, by Xander Ellis, political reporter. Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has blamed the pressure of the Queen's death for mistakes made in the UK government's mini budget. It comes after a screeching U-turn on Monday morning, so the top Tories scrap plans to abolish the 45p rate of income tax on earnings over £150,000. The policy had formed part of a swathe of measures announced in the mini budget, which would have seen £45 billion of increased borrowing to fund tax cuts for the wealthiest. Other parts of the package, such as the end to a cap on bankers' bonuses, are still on the UK government's agenda. Addressing the disastrous impact of his first real statement as Chancellor, Kwarteng blamed the death of the Queen. He told GB News, "It was a very quick time that we did it, and so you've got to remember the context. I mean, what was extraordinary about that month was that we had a new government and also we had the sad passing of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. So we had the nation in mourning, and then literally, 4 days after the funeral, we had the mini budget. It was high speed, high pressure environments. We could have, as David Cameron used to say, prepared the pitch a bit better." Queen Elizabeth passed on the afternoon of September the 8th, just 2 days after Liz Truss had taken over as Prime Minister. The Chancellor, who is fighting to keep hold of his job less than 1 month after taking it on, further repeated reports that the budget would be brought forward from November the 23rd. "People have been reading the runes and the pauses. It's going to be the 23rd, he said. He also stumbled on his own U-turn, claiming the scrapping of 45p upper tax rate had only been postponed before saying, "We have decided not to proceed with it." Speaking at his party's conference on Monday, and in an attempt to quell unrest around his performance, Kwarteng urged the Tories to focus on the task in hand. Kwarteng told Tory members on Monday, "What a day. It has been tough, but we need to focus on the job in hand. We need to move forward, no more distractions, we have a plan and we need to go on and deliver it." He acknowledged the plan put forward only 10 days ago had caused a little turbulence, comments which led to some laughter in the audience. The Chancellor's mini budget triggered turmoil in the city, was criticised by the International Monetary Fund, and resulted in a £65 billion emergency intervention by the Bank of England to restore order. Kwarteng and Prime Minister Liz Truss face a parliamentary bid to dock their pay following their gross mismanagement of the economy after the U-turn over the axing of the top rate of tax. The Liberal Democrats plan to table a censure motion in the House of Commons calling for the Prime Minister and the Chancellor to lose half of their additional salaries paid as part of their roles in government. And that article was by Xander Eliards. From The National, Tuesday the 4th of October 2022, from the politics section, Liz Truss forced to apologise for 2,500 energy price cap bungle, by Abby Garton Crosby. Prime Minister Liz Truss has been forced to apologise for bungling the specifics of her government's energy price cap during a car crash round of local radio interviews last week. When Truss was interviewed by a series of local BBC radio stations on Thursday, ahead of the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham, she repeatedly stated that consumers' power bills would be no more than £2,500. However, Truss was accused of mixing up the basic facts of her own policy in 7 of her 8. A fact-checking service wrote to the PM to demand that she clarify the government's position, as the cap is on unit price and depends on each household's usage. After the PM's apology, Fulfight urged her to go further to clarify her position. 5 days later, Truss was forced to admit she should have been more specific and admitted that her phrasing could have been misleading to consumers who were worried about their upcoming bills. Speaking to Nick Ferrari and LBC, the PM was initially asked if the UK government would be giving away any extra assistance to those with mortgages now that rates are set to rise following the introduction of Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng's disastrous mini-budget. Truss claimed that interest rates are going up globally due to the international economic situation. She said, "We are doing what we can to help homeowners, for example, by reducing stamp duty, helping people get on the housing ladder, but I wouldn't dismiss what we've done on energy bills. It is a massive, massive intervention, Nick, where people could have been facing bills of £6,000. We've kept that down to £2,500 for a typical household. Not just this winter, but also for the next winter as well. So that is providing security to a huge number of households across the country." Ferrari then pointed out that Truss had said in her local radio interview round last week that bills would be capped at £2,500. He said, "How come you were wrong twice? Because the bills aren't capped at £2,500. Why did you get it wrong twice?" Truss, rolling back on her previous claim, said, "I was talking about the typical bill. What we're actually doing is capping it per unit of energy, and that's the number I gave." Ferrari interrupted to say, "Of course, if I use more power..." Truss replied, "Well, I'm sorry I wasn't more specific." Asked if she got it wrong, the PM said, "I should have been more specific." Asked a second time if she was admitting she had made a mistake, Truss replied, "I agree, I should have been more specific." Truss made the claim during interviews with BBC Radio Leeds, Radio Kent, Radio Lancashire, Radio Nottingham, Radio Tees, Radio Bristol and Radio Stoke. Her interview with Radio Norfolk was dominated by questions on fracking and didn't include the energy cap claim. In her final interview with Radio Stoke, Truss was asked simply, "Have you taken the keys to the country and crashed the economy?" She said, "What we've done is we've taken decisive action on energy. So, from this weekend, we've made sure that families are paying no more than £2,500 typical bill in energy this winter and next winter." Will Moy, Chief Executive of Fulfight, said, "We welcome the fact that the Prime Minister has acknowledged her mistake in an interview, but this is the least we expect. Rising energy costs will affect us all, and politicians must be clear about the support available, especially when large numbers of people are confused about what the price cap means for them. The government must do more to clarify this mess. More than 32,000 people have joined Fulfight's campaign for honesty in politics. Any politician serious about turning the public's trust should be prepared to correct their mistakes." It comes after a screeching U-turn from Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng over the scrapping of the top rate of tax for highest earners. And that article was written by Abby Garton-Crosby.
From The National, Tuesday, the 4th of October, 2022, from the comment section. "The conduct of supporters will make or break the Yes campaign," by Karen Adam. Scotland in the UK today is a far cry from the one in 2014. 8 years on, and we are governed at Westminster by what some have described as one of the most right-wing governments in the world. The UK is a sinking ship trying to pull Scotland down as it goes. This is certainly something Scotland did not vote for, nor has it voted for a Conservative government in the last 60 years. The case for being an independent country has never been clearer or stronger. We are well armed with examples of not just what we could be now without the ties to Westminster, but also what we could have been. At a time when our younger generations are discussing alternative realities in their daily discourse, a topic especially popular on Reddit and TikTok, we can certainly wonder what could have been our alternative reality if we had taken the Yes path. We are abundant in evidence and examples of what we could have won, but how do we use this? How do we communicate this and get our message across to those who are still to be convinced? What is our message? We have so many perspectives on what the message is, and should be. We even have conservatives for yes, believe it or not. The ultimate message must surely be the argument for true democracy. The yes movement, to use an old term, is a broad church, and we obviously make up many differing views on our vision for the future we have in mind. My vision for an independent Scotland, I'm sure, differs greatly from that of some reading this piece right now. But ultimately, don't we all want that debate to be between us and us alone? It should be ours to have without interference, wholly in our Parliament and voted on fairly by Scottish citizens, using all the powers and levers at our disposal. To end UK rule, to have full autonomy and self-determination realised, is not the end goal. It's the beginning of so much more. Shaping and creating a country of our own free will and choice is what we aspire to. It's a lifetime's work and desire of many. Self-determination has free choice at its core. It is central to democracy. To choose to live our lives how we wish, to participate in society in our own way. We may not be free from consequences, good or bad, but freedom to choose should surely always preface that. How do we then sell choice, full autonomy and self-rule to those who are undecided or who are looking to switch from no to yes with the right argument to satisfy their apprehension? And why are some still unconvinced by our endeavours? There may be many reasons, but one that stands out to me is our message delivery, which is a crucial aspect of any campaign. Self-reflection is invaluable to understanding why some will not accept our message, and scrutinising the delivery of it is key to that understanding. We already know that we are viewed by our opposition as unruly and uncouth, or at least that perception is a narrative they push to delegitimise anything we say or do. We need only look at what surprise there was to how people in Scotland handled the passing of the Queen, that sombre, dignified approach which took them aback. I cannot imagine for the life of me what they expected. At every turn, there is an effort to delegitimise us and our movement, and our behaviour will ultimately be a deciding factor in how we are portrayed and if our arguments will be given legitimacy by those we seek to convince. They want people to think we are incapable and too reactive to be trusted. Good relationships build trust and ensure genuine connections with people. It is these genuine connections which will open the hearts and minds of others to the message we are conveying. If we look at conduct around us, we need only ask ourselves if a particular behaviour of an individual or group has ever caused us to disengage from their message. Then ask what we can do to ensure that we are conducting ourselves in a manner that doesn't make people disengage from us. We can no longer preach to the converted and imagine that it will have an impact on anyone undecided, or seek to abuse and vilify each other online, thinking that it, in any way, shape or form, will convince anyone of the merits of an independent Scotland. There is plenty to be angry about, that I am sure nobody can deny. But when we show self-control in our actions and our words are respectful, we become a place of refuge in an ever more verbally violent debating bubble. We can't control another person's actions or words, and of course, why should we? It is their choice, but we can control how we act and respond to them. Our conduct while campaigning can determine the ultimate outcome. Therefore, I am delighted to see the code of conduct on the final agenda for the SNP conference. Our conduct will make or break our campaign. That I am sure of. Committing ourselves to being composed and considerate will not only strengthen us as a movement, but it will also protect us from any efforts to delegitimise our message, and it will attract people to join us. Dignified behaviours are a sign of strength and resolve, which our opposition fear. Make no mistake, they want to see us chaotic and uncivilised, as it plays into their narrative. A civic movement where we engage in good faith with integrity and respect is a noble aspiration. After all, our cause is a noble one, true democracy. That article was by Karen Adams, MSP for Banffshire and Buchan Coast. From The National, Tuesday the 4th of October 2022, from the comment section. Shona Craven, Tory incompetence is now stranger than fiction. Falling asleep in front of the TV is always a tactical error. But falling asleep in front of BBC thriller The Capture in the current climate is discombobulating in the extreme. If you haven't watched it yet, you absolutely must, and I won't give away too many spoilers. Suffice it to say, the second series will leave you questioning everything you see and hear, especially statements from politicians and footage of their curious behaviour. When I woke up yesterday, in bed, thankfully, to learn that Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng had U-turned on scrapping the top rate of income tax, I needed to see the footage for myself. Something about this wasn't adding up. Unfortunately, scrutinising captures of media interviews with members of the current UK government is of no use whatsoever, and risks triggering a spiral of paranoia. In the BBC's fictional universe, the telltale signs of digital trickery are things like a lagging feed, a seamless edit, or a slightly off mannerism. But these days, you needn't be a cybersecurity expert to feel like you're watching a live feed from the uncanny valley. I expect if you squinted hard enough at the screen during Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, you'd start thinking you could make out Liz Truss's battery light blinking. The Prime Minister's current communication strategy seems to be pausing for so long in response to questions about the UK's economic meltdown that listeners will think the phone connection has dropped and change radio stations accordingly. 2018-era jokes about the Maybot ring hollow now that it seems the Prime Minister really might be waiting for someone to WhatsApp her the right lines from a script, or even feed them into software that recreates her trademark stilted delivery. Clips of Michael Gove gurning in the Commons start to look wholesome compared to those of Kwasi Kwarteng swaying and chuckling to himself at the Queen's funeral. On a good day, this bunch of smirking chaos merchants behave like juddering automata from a chamber of horrors that someone either needs to wind back up or, preferably, smash into tiny pieces and throw down a deep well. Let's not forget that Truss was selected despite the fact that she is incapable of anything resembling competent delivery of sentences, maybe even partly because of it. I may not be the slickest presenter in the business, she understated to viewers of a BBC debate back in July, implying that there was something highly suspect about Rishi Sunak's ability to sometimes fluently answer the questions put to him as though his human brain and flesh mouth were actually connected to each other. Setting aside, with some difficulty, the fact that the people running the UK are giving off heavy Invasion of the Body Snatchers vibes, let's consider the substance of what they are saying and doing. The Capture grapples with big issues of national and international security and the risk of politicians being compromised, corrupted, or simply removed and replaced by foreign actors, whether by political skullduggery or technical trickery. It doesn't take a detective inspector to start questioning why a government minister might be making decisions that appear, to anyone with half a brain, to be entirely against the national interest, while ignoring the advice of the relevant expert committees and offering implausible rationales for what he's doing. Could it be the result of a blackmail plot? A symptom of a brain tumour? Or does it point to the existence of a global tech conspiracy that goes deeper than even the spookiest spooks of MI5 comprehend? Unfortunately, once again, truth is stranger than fiction. And the British public have simply had to resign themselves to the fact that there is no deep state or deep fake conspiracy here. Tory politicians really are just trashing the UK because they are villains or idiots or some combination of the two. If Truss and Kwarteng are being manipulated, it's been going on for a while, and it's not been very subtle, because they sketched out their radical economic ambitions in their 2012 book, Britannia unchained. Even if Truss was rather coy about her actual policy plans during the appalling waste of time that was the recent Tory leadership campaign. It's Kwarteng's U-turn that should raise suspicions, given how recently he and Truss were firmly asserting that they were right and everyone else was wrong, and that they weren't afraid to do things that would make them unpopular. They don't really expect us to believe that the shortening of the pound was the result of a silly misunderstanding, but they've stopped short of saying that it was a price worth paying. Perversely, the best outcome for the PM and her Chancellor might be for the media to howl that they are incompetent, that they didn't think through the consequences of their actions, and that they accidentally caused economic mayhem. The alternative, of course, is that they knew exactly what they were doing and what the result would be. And isn't that the scarier possibility? That article was by Shona Craven.
The National News on Wednesday, the 5th of October. Health Secretary announces £600 million plan to bolster NHS over winter. An article written by Ninian Wilson. Scotland's Health Secretary has announced £600 million will be used to shore up the NHS over the winter months, but hinted that it will not mitigate every single challenge. Hamza Yousaf said the Scottish Government would provide £8 million from the current year's budget to recruit 1,000 new staff, including 750 nurses, midwives and allied health professionals from overseas. A further £124 million will be given to health and social care partnerships to expand the capacity of care at home initiatives. £45 million to support recruitment and planning in the Scottish Ambulance Service and extension of the Social Care Staff Support Fund to the end of March. Announcing the move in Holyrood on Tuesday, Mr. Yousaf said the Scottish Government was committed to easing pressures caused by the pandemic, but added, "As winter arrives, those pressures will undoubtedly have a detrimental impact on already stretched services, but we'll do what we can to mitigate the worst effects of these." He added, "The coming months will be a test for our health and social care systems, and indeed the incredible workforce therein. I wish I could stand here and tell you, and tell the Chamber, that we'll be able to mitigate every single challenge this winter will throw at us. However, recovery is a process, and I've always been upfront in saying that this recovery journey we're on will take years, not weeks, or indeed a few months. I hope our winter plan set out the measures we'll take to bolster the workforce, to reduce demand by treating people at home or as close to home as possible during this difficult period." The Health Secretary thanked health and social care staff for all their unbelievable efforts during the pandemic, adding, "There can be no recovery if we don't take care of your well-being, which is this government's top priority." Mr. Yousaf's statement comes as figures published on Tuesday showed August had the worst A&E waiting times on record, with almost 5,000 people across Scotland waiting longer than 12 hours to be seen and subsequently discharged or admitted. Almost 900 operations were cancelled by hospitals in August, and the number of people in hospital who were well enough to be discharged jumped by 20% compared with last year, according to official statistics. Scottish Tory MSP Tess White said staff had been badly let down by this SNP Green government. She added, "The system isn't just stretched, it's overstretched. Few people, apart from the SNP benches, will be reassured by the Cabinet Secretary's statement today." Scottish Labour Deputy Leader Jackie Bailey said that since the Health Secretary took up his post last year, things have got worse and there's little recognition of the scope of the challenge in this new plan. Nurses are balloting for strike action. There are 7,500 vacancies across the NHS, a staggering increase of 169% since the SNP came to power, she said. "Staff tell me that patients are at risk because wards are short-staffed. One nurse to 30 patients in some wards, and now we have as many as 50% of junior doctors thinking about leaving." Ms. Bailey described staff as the backbone of the NHS, asking what action the Health Secretary was taking. Mr. Yousaf said Labour's deputy leader was doing a disservice to the health service if she doesn't recognise some of the recovery that has been made. the Health Secretary added that he was looking to get back around the table with the Royal College of Nursing to hash out an improved pay offer, and referred to the plans to increase staffing levels in the NHS as a key central plank of the winter strategy. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The National News on Wednesday, the 5th of October. Jack Nicklaus reveals plans for £80 million golf development in Aberdeenshire. An article written by Ninian Wilson. Legendary golfer Jack Nicklaus has unveiled plans for an £80 million golf and housing project in Aberdeenshire. The development will be built in the Urie Estate near Stonehaven and will complement the 18-hole Jack Nicklaus signature golf course there. The first phase of the 1,600-acre project will be made up of self-build plots and five-bedroomed homes in the Nicklaus village, most of which offer a view of the course itself. The 82-year-old golfer said, "Here we are, just south of Aberdeen, in Stonehaven, with the beautiful castle on the hill. You stand up there with the castle, you see the bay and the water. It's a pretty view and a pretty area, with great tradition. The Scottish people have always been very nice to me. I guess they like somebody who excels at what they do, and I've excelled in Scotland. Any time you win at St Andrews, you've got to play some pretty special golf, and it's a very special feeling. Bobby Jones always said that your golfing resume is not complete unless you've won at St Andrews. I won at St Andrews, and I'm proud that I won again at St Andrews." He added that the project looked to create a way of life around what we've done, and that he would like for it to participate in the growth and feeling of the community. The golfer's firm has already designed more than 435 courses in 46 countries, with the Urie Estate course expected to open in 2024. Jonathan Milne from site owner and developer, the FM Group, said that they couldn't be more excited to launch the project in Scotland's northeast. He added, "Nicklaus companies have a proven track record of creating stunning residential communities at their courses worldwide, and we're very proud to be bringing Europe's first Nicklaus-branded residential development to Scotland. Urie Estate is a unique development which is set to be one of the world's most prestigious golfing destinations. We're delighted to be creating the opportunity for people to buy or build their dream home at the course." The Nicklaus village at Urie Estate offers a luxury lifestyle experience, with family homes situated in a country setting, affording a spectacular panorama of the Aberdeenshire countryside and coastline. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 5th of October. Truss must perform U-turn over obscene plans to cut benefits. An article written by Adam Robertson. The SNP has said that Liz Truss must perform a U-turn over obscene Tory plans to slash benefits after the Prime Minister refused to rule out imposing real terms cuts. Some Tory MPs have said that benefits must be increased in line with inflation. The pressure was increased as it emerged that Mr. Kwarteng's medium-term fiscal plan and the Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts will be moved ahead from November the 23rd to a date shortly in the future. SNP MP Kirsty Blackman said Tory cuts and economic mismanagement have pushed millions into poverty, and called on the UK government to deliver an above-inflation rise to benefits. She said the Prime Minister's plan to impose a new wave of Tory austerity cuts is utterly obscene and underlines the need for Scotland to become an independent country so we can escape Westminster control and get rid of the Tories for good. Liz Truss has shown appalling judgment and staggering incompetence. She must perform a third U-turn this week by scrapping Tory plans to slash benefits and impose £18 billion worth of cuts, which threatens Scotland's budget and the NHS. The UK government should be reversing the damage it's caused, not doubling down on cuts and pushing more people into poverty. The Prime Minister was pressed on LBC about why she's committed to increasing pensions but not benefits. She said that no decision has been made yet on benefit uprating and that it will be taken in due course. Ms. Truss added, "What I mean is when people are on a fixed income, when they're pensioners, it's quite hard to adjust. I think it's a different situation for people who are in the position of being able to work." The Scottish Greens Social Security spokesperson Maggie Chapman accused the UK government of doubling down on the cruel policies that have already done so much damage. She added, "To inflict cuts on many of the most vulnerable people would be appalling at any time, but to do it in order to fund tax breaks for some of the world's wealthiest corporations is contemptible. It'll only fuel the social emergency that's being inflicted." Ms. Blackman added, "The Prime Minister must increase benefits in real terms, scrap the cap, and follow the SNP government's lead by matching progressive policies, including the Scottish Children Payment." An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 5th of October. Scotland loses out on nuclear fusion plant. An article written by Hamish Morrison. Scotland has lost out on the chance to host a pioneering nuclear fusion plant as the project was awarded to a rival location south of the border. A group involving Glasgow University and North Ayrshire Council had put in a bid to host the spherical tokamak for energy production on the Ardeer Peninsula near Stevenston, but lost out to a competitor in West Burton in Nottinghamshire. It would have seen the project bring around 4,500 jobs to North Ayrshire. Making the announcement at the Tory party conference, Energy Secretary Jacob Rees-Mogg said, "We will build the UK's first prototype fusion energy plant in Nottinghamshire, replacing the West Burton coal-fired power station with a beacon of bountiful green energy. The plant will be the first of its kind, built by 2040 and capable of putting energy on the grid. In doing so, it will prove the commercial viability of fusion energy to the world." The Fusion Forward, Ardeer bid, made it to the final five of the competition and was the only Scottish site considered in the final judgment. The leader of the Scottish bid, Professor Declan Diver of Glasgow University, indicated he was not giving up his hope for future nuclear fusion sites to be based in Scotland. He said, "While I'm disappointed that our bid to bring fusion energy to North Ayrshire was unsuccessful, I'm pleased that the UK is set to make fusion a viable source of zero carbon power. Over the course of the last 18 months, we've done a great deal of work to win the backing of the business, education and skills sectors across Scotland. In doing so, we've created a framework for collaboration that could easily be used to support future bids to bring large-scale infrastructure and investment projects to Ardeer. There's also the possibility that related opportunities could come to the region between now and 2040, when the plant is expected to start generating power." North Ayrshire Council leader Marie Burns said, "While it's clear there will be disappointment for many that Ardeer won't be home to the fusion plant, there's still much to be positive about. We've shown what's possible for a unique location like Ardeer, and we know that it remains a prime site ready for the right development. We'll continue to pursue innovation and investment opportunities throughout North Ayrshire, and this process has demonstrated that our area has much to offer as a desirable location for large-scale investment. The experience we've gained working with partners on this project puts us in a strong position for commercial development and very attractive to prospective investors and employers. While the plant would have brought significant investment, jobs and training opportunities to the west of Scotland, we'll continue to explore different possibilities and opportunities for our area. It's important that we don't lose momentum. We'll do everything we can to ensure that North Ayrshire will benefit from fusion and the emerging UK fusion energy industry as part of the large-scale supply chains and advanced manufacturing in not only this but other burgeoning areas such as aerospace and offshore renewables. Fusion is the process which goes on inside the sun and creates energy by forcing atoms together. It remains experimental, with scientists struggling to harness the clean power created by the process, which is the opposite of nuclear fission, where atoms are ripped apart to create power." An article written by Hamish Morrison. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 5th of October. UK government chasing gas supply deal with Norway to avoid winter blackouts. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The UK government is eyeing up a deal with Norway to secure a 20-year contract to receive natural gas in an effort to prevent winter blackouts, an unnamed source has said. According to Bloomberg, an insider said that UK ministers are looking to agree on a price with the Norwegian government, but that because of the length of the proposed contract, there's a risk the UK could be locked into high costs long term. Current price fluctuations mean that suppliers could demand higher prices to bolster their profits, but there's uncertainty over whether they can make more money by selling now or in the future. The UK government is said to be eager to avoid the risk of embarrassment over potential power failures, following Ofgem's warning of a significant risk of gas shortages, forcing power stations to be switched off this winter. Europe's gas supplies have been under mounting pressure as Russia has looked to undermine European energy security following sanctions for its invasion of Ukraine. Liz Truss has also hinted at discussions taking place while speaking with Sky News, saying we're looking at long-term energy contracts with other countries. She added, I've not signed any deal. Meanwhile, Energy Secretary Jacob Rees-Mogg told a meeting at the Tory party conference that he's been speaking with a friendly country about energy supply. Talks are also being held between the UK and American liquefied natural gas producers for 20-year term supply contracts. The government's team tasked with energy supply negotiations for new gas deals is being led by former mergers and acquisitions banker Madeleine McTernan, who was also in charge of the task force that secured COVID vaccines during the pandemic. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 5th of October. UK government to trash international law with Suella Braverman's asylum ban. An article written by Xander Eliads. The UK government looks set to trash international laws after the Home Secretary announced plans to ban anybody who enters Britain illegally from claiming asylum. Home Secretary Suella Braverman told the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham that she wanted the kind of immigration that grows our economy, adding, parts of the system aren't delivering. We need to end abuse of the rules and cut down on those numbers that aren't meeting the needs of our economy. The ban on asylum claims marks a new tactic to try to drive down the number of small boats crossing the English Channel after Ms. Braverman's dream of flying asylum seekers to Rwanda stalled amid a slew of legal challenges. The new move has led to warnings that the UK government risks breaking international law. Sabir Zazai, chief executive of the Scottish Refugee Council and a former asylum seeker, said, this government is shamefully playing politics with the lives of people who have fled war, terror and oppression. Under the UN Refugee Convention, to which the UK is a founding signatory, there is no illegal method of arrival to a country to seek asylum. Article 31 of the 1951 Convention states that states shall not impose penalties on account of their illegal entry or presence on refugees who are present in their territory without authorisation, provided they present themselves without delay to the authorities and show good cause for their illegal entry or presence. Ms. Braverman's plan to ban anyone who crosses the Channel from claiming asylum would be in breach of this convention. It may also be in breach of a landmark 1999 English legal case, which concluded that refugees do not have to claim asylum in the first safe country they reach to be protected by Article 31. The SNP's shadow Home Secretary, Stuart MacDonald MP, said that the announcement from Ms. Braverman would do nothing to slow Channel crossings, adding, not only are her proposals cruel, they trash the Refugee Convention and the Human Rights Convention. The UK government must realise these plans will achieve nothing except cause extra pain and misery. Claire Mosley, founder of refugee charity Care for Calais, said, there is a mountain of evidence that the vast majority are genuine refugees. This criminalisation of them is blatant victim blaming of incredibly vulnerable people. An article written by Xander Eliads. The National News on Wednesday, the 5th of October. Unions call for urgent meeting with First Minister over the future of the Scottish rail network. An article written by Craig Meegan. Scotland's rail unions have called for a meeting with First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to discuss the future of the network, accusing the Scottish Government of a lack of vision for train services. ASLEF, UNITE, the Rail Maritime and Transport Workers Union and the Transport Salary Staffs Association have written to the First Minister a year on from the A Vision for Scotland's Railway report, where they outlined their hopes for the network, such as removing peak fares, extending concessionary bus travel to the train network and modernising rolling stock. ASLEF's Kevin Lindsay said it's time for the Scottish Government to pick whose side they're on. He said, "We want to hear if she agrees with our vision of affordable fares, expanded services, accessible, well-staffed and attractive stations, enhanced freight services and the privateers driven out of our industry." Sadly, up until now, the Scottish Government has not shared our vision. It comes after a summer of bitter industrial disputes between rail unions, Network Rail and the UK Government, which sparked strikes across the network, causing disruption for passengers. Further strikes are planned for today and Saturday. ASLEF drivers will walk out across several companies, including Avanti West Coast and Cross Country, and Network Rail staff who are members of the RMT union will walk out on Saturday. While ScotRail staff are not directly impacted by the strikes, services on Saturday will still be affected. A letter signed by several trade union representatives said, "On one hand, there's our vision for public ownership across all parts of our rail services, investment and transformation to make our rail services world-class, and there is the Tory and privateer vision for managed decline, which includes attacking the wages, terms and conditions of the greatest asset our railways have, its workforce." An article written by Craig Meegan.
Reportage from The National on the 6th of October 2022 from the Culture section, recorded by Amy. New knitting book inspired by University of Glasgow Architecture published by Fiona O'Hara. Historians at Scottish and American universities have come together to produce a knitting patterns book inspired by University of Glasgow's architecture, collaborating with Scottish knitwear designers. Knitting the University of Glasgow book was compiled by Professor Lynn Abrams and Professor Marina Moskowicz, both historians of Scottish knitted textiles, and Christel Lilliger, research coordinator at the University's School of Humanities. The book is part of the Fleece to Fashion project, which is researching the history of knitted textiles in Scotland from around 1780 to the present day. Heed knitters will be able to knit a teapot cosy inspired by the windows on the historic main building, a beanie hat based on the iconic cloister's arches, or a scarf whose design is based on the university spires that pierce the Glasgow skyline. Glasgow Professor Abrams said the genesis of this book of knitting patterns inspired by the built environment of the University of Glasgow lies in research carried out by historians at the University of Glasgow into the economies and cultures of hand knitting in Scotland from the 18th century to the present. Scotland's long tradition of knitwear production is rightly celebrated. It feels fitting, therefore, to celebrate the beauty of the University of Glasgow's iconic buildings in knitted form. We hope that this book will be well received by knitters around the world, as our own branded wool, Concho Wool, was when we launched that in 2018. Professor Moskowicz of the University of Wisconsin said, "Our aim as historians is to investigate the place and significance of hand-knitted textiles to Scotland's economy and culture in the past, the present and the future. Studying knitting can be used to think about the role of craft in linking individual creativity to economic pursuits, local design traditions to national heritage and domestic economies to the creative economy of Scotland. Scotland's rich heritage of hand-knitted textiles contributes to other national industries such as tourism and fashion." The article was by Fiona O'Hara. Recorded from The National on the 5th of October 2022, from the Culture section, recorded by Amy. Primal Scream and Dexy Star record song in support of striking rail workers, by Adam Robertson. Scottish music stars are amongst those recording a song in support of railway workers embroiled in a dispute over jobs, pay and conditions. Primal Scream's Bobby Gillespie and Andrew Innes, Dexy Midnight Runners musicians Kevin Rowland and Sean Reed, and Jesus and Mary Chain bassist Douglas Hart have joined forces to produce a song and a video. They are working on the song titled Enough is Enough to highlight their backing for strikes by rail workers and against austerity. Rowland said the Rail, Maritime and Transports Union's battle for workplace justice had been an inspiration for millions of people. He said RMT has been leading the way on behalf of working people, and now other unions are joining the fight against low pay and this government that is trying to screw working people into the ground. Rail services are set to be severely disrupted on October 8th and 10th, with ScotRail urging customers to avoid travelling unless it's absolutely necessary. On Tuesday, it was revealed that Scotland's rail unions have called for a meeting with the First Minister to discuss the future of the network. RMT General Secretary Mick Lynch will make a guest appearance on the track with some of his now famous responses to questions from the media. He said, "My union is thrilled that musical legends such as Primal Scream and Dexys and others want to support workers in struggle. It shows the growing amount of support for social justice and the fact that trade unions are the only thing that stand in the way of the endless austerity and poverty." This song will be released at the end of October. That article was by Adam Robertson. Recorded from the National on the 6th of October 2022, from the Culture section, recorded by Amy. Edinburgh and Aberdeen Filmhouse cinemas shut with immediate effect as administrators called in. By Laura Webster. Two acclaimed independent cinemas in Scotland have announced they will stop trading with immediate effect as administrators are called in. The Filmhouse Cinema and Café Bar in Edinburgh and the Belmount Filmhouse in Aberdeen have faced the perfect storm of sharply rising costs, according to the charity running the venues. The Centre for Moving Image, CMI, also runs the Edinburgh International Film Festival, which will stop trading too as administrators assess the charity's future. According to the CMI, energy costs and reduced trade have had a major impact on the cinema sector. Now immediate action is required in the face of unprecedented challenges. In a statement, the charity's board said, "We have been proud to have led the CMI through incredibly challenging times, and in particular during the worst days of the pandemic. Unfortunately, the combination of sharply increasing energy and other costs, together with both the lasting impacts of the pandemic and the rapidly emerging cost of living crisis affecting cinema attendances, means that we have had no other option but to appoint administrators at this time. We would like to put on record our immense gratitude to the entire staff team whose passion for film as an art form and for the audiences and communities we work with and serve has remained undented by the challenges of recent years. We're fully aware this will be an exceptionally stressful time for them." Media in Aberdeen reported that workmen were on the Belmont site changing the locks after the news was announced. The CMI said that energy costs are going up by around £200,000 over the next 12 months. With the UK government's energy cap only scheduled to last 6 months, planning into the next year is difficult. As a registered real living wage employer, the charity is also facing an increase of payroll costs of 10.1% on top of the additional energy fees. The CMI also blamed stagnant public funding, general inflation and poor trading for the financial struggles, with cinema admissions at just 50% of their pre-pandemic levels. What happens now? Tom McLennan and Chad Griffin of FRP Advisory have been appointed as joint administrators and will work alongside Creative Scotland, City of Edinburgh Council and Aberdeen City Council to find a way forward. A spokesperson for Creative Scotland said, "We are saddened by the news from CMI, the loss of employment of cultural cinema programming in Edinburgh and Aberdeen, and the impact on the Edinburgh International Film Festival. We are working to explore future options for such cinema programming in both Edinburgh and Aberdeen, and for Edinburgh International Film Festival's 2023 edition." Culture Secretary Angus Robertson added, "I'm concerned by the situation facing the Centre for the Moving Image and the implications this has for its staff, as well as for the creative and cultural sector in Scotland. This is an incredibly worrying time for everyone involved." CMI plays an important role in Scotland's cinema and festival landscape, across the Edinburgh Filmhouse, the Belmont Filmhouse in Aberdeen and the Edinburgh International Film Festival. "We understand that Creative Scotland is in talks to explore alternative options for cultural programming, and we are continuing to engage with Creative Scotland on this developing situation." Challenges in the sector. It comes as Holyrood's Cultural Committee heard that rising costs are creating a perfect storm for Scotland's cultural organisations, with up to a quarter facing insolvency in the next few months. On Thursday morning, the Chief Executive of Creative Scotland said, "Problems are particularly bad for groups based in buildings with large fixed costs, such as theatres." Ian Munro told the committee, "It is fighting for survival in many quarters. I'm very concerned about that perfect storm at the moment. I don't want us to do anything that's going to add to the challenges of that." Culture Secretary Angus Robertson spoke to the committee later on Thursday. He acknowledged the difficulties the sector is facing, noting government spending is currently under review. Robertson said there's a mixed picture around audiences returning after the pandemic, adding, "Most of all, there is continuing uncertainty as the rising cost of living means that people are undoubtedly cutting back on leisure spending." That article was by Laura Webster.
From The National, Thursday the 6th of October 2022, from the politics section, Nadine Dorries says Liz Truss could lead Tories to landslide general election defeat. Article by Adam Robertson. Former Cabinet Minister Nadine Dorries has said Liz Truss needs to change course or the Prime Minister will risk leading the Tories to a landslide defeat at the next general election. Dorries backed Truss during her leadership campaign, but said she feared the Prime Minister was lurching to the right and abandoning the centre ground to the Labour Party. The Prime Minister delivered her keynote speech at the Tory Party conference on Wednesday, as polling suggested her popularity was below both Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn at their lowest. Dorries told The Times, "I understand that we need to rocket boost our growth, but you don't do that by throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You don't win elections by lurching to the right and deserting the centre ground for Keir Starmer to place his flag on. If we continue down this path, we absolutely will be facing a Stephen Harper type wipeout. I'm sure she's listened and will stop and rethink." Former Canadian Prime Minister Harper lost power to Justin Trudeau in the 2015 election following a decade of Conservative rule. Dorries also expressed concerns about the rolling back from raising benefits in line with inflation, which would mean a real terms cut in welfare for the poorest households during a cost of living crisis. It's a move which has been heavily criticised by both the SNP and Scottish Greens. "It would be cruel, unjust and fundamentally unconservative," Dorries said. She also renewed her warning that a radical departure from the 2019 manifesto would require another general election. During her keynote address on Wednesday, Truss launched a furious attack on the anti-growth coalition she believes is holding the UK back and vowed to face down the separatists she believed were threatening the union. She accused opposition parties, trade unions, think tanks, anti-Brexit campaigners and environmentalists of joining forces to block her attempts to grow the economy. Truss said, "We must stay the course. We are the only party with a clear plan to get Britain moving. We're the only party with the determination to deliver. Together, we can unleash the full potential of our great country. That is how we build a new Britain for a new era." This comes as new research suggested the Conservatives would return zero Scottish MPs at the next election. And that article is by Adam Robertson. From The National, Thursday the 6th of October 2022, from the news section, nursing union urges strike action for the first ballot in 106-year history, by Adam Robertson. Nursing leaders have said they had no option but to ask members to go on strike for the first time in their union's 100-year history. The Royal College of Nursing Scotland is balloting its members on industrial action, with Chair Julie Lambert urging staff to support a strike. She warned that without action, the situation nurses are facing will only get worse. Speaking ahead of the ballot opening on Thursday, she said, "That we have got to this point is simply shocking, but we have been left with no option. For years we have been overlooked and undervalued, expected to carry on regardless. Patient care is suffering, staffing levels are unsafe, and members are facing a daily battle of how to feed their family, heat their homes and travel to work. None of this is new, as we head into another winter, we know it's only going to get worse. This is our opportunity to take a stand for our patients and our profession, to show the Scottish Government that they must act now, and that is why I'm urging members to vote in favour of strike action." Trade Union Unison is already balloting more than 50,000 health workers on strike action, where the Royal College of Midwives in Scotland opened its ballot last month. Health Secretary Hamza Yousaf has promised NHS staff that he will make a significantly improved offer after the record 5% pay rise put forward by the Scottish Government was rejected. Speaking on Wednesday, he said, "I will be doing everything in my power to prevent industrial action from taking place, which includes our next meeting with trade unions coming forward with a significantly improved pay offer for them." Director of RCN Scotland, Colin Pullman, insisted nursing staff must be paid fairly for the critical work they do. He said, "Nursing staff will always put patient safety first, and our members will not take the decision to vote for strike action lightly. They have been forced into this position by the failure of the Scottish Government to address the nursing workforce crisis and to ensure nursing staff are paid fairly for the critical work that they do. Ministers must come back with a significantly improved offer that responds to our members' concerns." And that piece was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 6th of October 2022, from the news section, "Researchers uncover secrets of Scottish fossil of cat-sized dinosaur," by Jean McLeod. A fossilised reptile unearthed in Scotland lived during the Age of Dinosaurs and was closely related to an extinct group of flying reptiles known as pterosaurs, new research suggests. The small cat-sized creature, named Scleromochalus tellurii, is thought to have roamed the planet somewhere between 240 million to 210 million years ago. Pterosaurs were one of the first animals to evolve powered flight, and the researchers believe that Scleromochalus may hold a key place in its evolutionary tree. The paleontologists said their findings, published in the journal Nature, could help shed more light on the origins of pterosaurs. Sterling Nisbet, an associate professor at Virginia Tech in the US and one of the authors of the study, said, "Pterosaurs were the first vertebrates to evolve powered flight, and, for nearly two centuries, we did not know their closest relatives. Now we can start filling in their evolutionary history with the discovery of tiny close relatives that enhance our knowledge about how they lived and where they came from." Pterosaurs were close cousins of dinosaurs, who evolved on a separate branch of the reptile family tree. Some species were as large as a fighter jet, while others were as small as paper planes. Scleromochalus was no more than 20 centimetres long. It had a large head, a long tail, a short neck, a slender body, and stood on spindly legs. Fossilised remains of the creature were first discovered more than 100 years ago in the Morayshire region of northeast Scotland around Elgin. However, the fossil was poorly preserved in sandstone, so scientists were unable to study its anatomical features in detail. This led to debates amongst experts as to whether Scleromochalus was closer to pterosaurs or if the creature had more in common with dinosaurs in the evolutionary tree. First author, Dr. David Foffa, Research Associate at National Museum Scotland and now a research fellow at the University of Birmingham, said, "It's exciting to be able to resolve a debate that's been going on for over a century. But it is far more amazing to be able to see and understand an animal which lived 230 million years ago and its relationship with the first animals ever to have flown. This is another discovery which highlights Scotland's important place in the global fossil record and also the importance of museum collections that preserve such specimens, allowing us to use new techniques and technologies to continue to learn from them long after their discovery." The researchers used a CT scan to reconstruct the skeleton of Scleromochalus. The findings suggest the reptile may have belonged to Pterosauromorpha. The class includes pterosaurs and a group of small reptiles called lagerpetids. The experts believe their work supports the hypothesis that pterosaurs evolved from small, probably two-legged ancestors. And that article is by Jane McLeod. From the National, Thursday the 6th of October 2022, from the news section, "Unison's Christina Macania to attack UK government in Jimmy Reid lecture," by Judith Duffy. The head of the UK's largest trade union is to attack Downing Street for seeing it as the enemy within, in contrast to the inclusive approach of the devolved governments. UNISON General Secretary Cristina Macanea is to highlight how the Scottish Government was involved in talks in a local government pay negotiations when she delivers the annual Jimmy Reid Foundation lecture on the cost of living crisis at Glasgow City Chambers tonight. She will outline how Nicola Sturgeon was personally involved in trying to find a resolution, but added, I can't imagine Liz Truss or any of her cabinet doing that. Macanea, who is from Glasgow and the first woman General Secretary of UNISON, will also highlight the pressures facing the NHS, warning that staff going on strike will not make the situation worse as the health service is already on its knees. During the lecture, she will see that union members are pragmatists who will work with any government. But she will add, I can see the difference in our relationship with the governments in Scotland and Wales, and even Northern Ireland, when they have a government. We are all seen as part of civil society, not as the enemy within, as we are by the current lot in Downing Street. During the recent government pay talks in Scotland, held over two intense weekends, the Scottish Government were in the room. Nicola Sturgeon got personally involved in trying to find a resolution, and I know Mark Drakeford in Wales would do the same. I can't imagine Liz Truss or any of her cabinet doing that. UNISON has begun balloting more than 50,000 health workers in Scotland on strike action. Health Secretary Hamza Yousaf has said he will do everything in his power to prevent industrial action after the 5% pay increase offered by the Scottish Government was rejected. Macanea will highlight how staff in England, Wales and Northern Ireland will also be balloted in the coming weeks, meaning around 400,000 NHS workers are expected to be involved by November. That's huge. I don't think any union has ever balloted that many. The sheer logistics of it are massive, she will say. And we face a real challenge in getting the vote out. And, of course, if our NHS members vote for strike action, we will be accused of putting lives at risk. But I've been speaking to our NHS workers, nurses, ambulance workers, hospital cleaners, who say the service is already on its knees, that it's so bad, going on strike won't actually make it worse, but will draw attention to it. And I see this as the General Secretary of the UK's biggest union. We don't bring members out to bring down governments. We bring them out to get results, to improve their paying conditions. And that article was by Judith Duffy.
And that was this week's The National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.